morning. Please be seated. The second case on the panel's oral argument scheduled today is Bernardo Vega versus the State of Nevada, case number 53752. Ms. Burke, you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor, thank you.
Good morning, Justices, Ms. Lucich. I'm Susan Burke. I represent Bernardo Vega in this appeal, but I was not his trial counsel. If it pleases the court, my intention today is to concentrate on issue B, the hearsay issue related to the testimony of Dr. Maida. I would also like to address the first issue related to the age, the proof of age, as to some of the accounts of some of the counts, if that is agreeable to the court. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Now, as to issue B, which relates to Dr. Maida's testimony, I believe there are four main questions that need to be asked. One, was Dr. Maida's testimony hearsay? Number two, was that hearsay testimonial? Number three, did the testimony violate Mr. Vega's constitutional rights to confrontation? And was the four, with the erroneous admission of this hearsay, plain error, entitling him to vacation of his convictions and remand for a new trial? I would submit that all of these questions can be answered in the affirmative. I will take them one by one. First, it was hearsay. What happened in this case was that Phyllis Souter, a sane nurse, did a SAINT exam on the complainant and was out of town at the time of trial. The state therefore brought in Dr. Maida to testify. The district attorney indicated that because Ms. Souter was out of town, she had asked Dr. Maida to come and tell her what Souter had found. Specifically, she asked, quote, "Are you here to testify regarding what her findings were?" unquote. Dr. Maida said she was just testifying as to what she read on Souter's documents. Dr. Maida never spoke to Souter concerning this particular examination. Maida never interviewed the complainant, Diane Venequez. Maida said she was there to testify regarding Souter's findings. The district attorney specifically asked Dr. Maida, quote, "What did Ms. Souter indicate that she found?" Dr. Maida testified as to what Souter wrote and depicted on her diagram. Dr. Maida also testified that after looking at the video that was taken at the examination, there was an area of concern and something not quite right, both of those in quotes. But she volunteered that she was at a disadvantage because the person who performed the exam would have a better idea of what was really shown on the video.
So you would disagree with the state that this is not just a restatement of testimony that Deanna made or could make and be cross-examined as to?
These particular things in terms of what Ms. Souter found is nothing that Diane could have testified to and been cross-examined about. And all of these things so far are things that Dr. Maida related as to what Ms. Souter had found. Excuse me. The only other time that Dr. Maida gave her opinion was that what she saw on Ms. Souter's diagram was consistent with what Diane described. But the problem is we have no way of knowing what Diane described to Ms. Souter because we have Ms. Souter's interpretation of that, and obviously she was influenced by the accuracy that Dr. Maida was influenced by the accuracy of Ms. Souter's markings on the diagram. Now, as to the testimony concerning what Diane told her, I think that this sort of exacerbates the problem with Ms. Souter's testimony in that in this case we have what Ms. Souter asked Diane, we have what Diane told Ms. Souter, and we have Dr. Maida's testimony about those things. The problem is we don't know exactly what Ms. Suter asked her, and we don't know what kind of filter Ms. Suter put on what Diane told her. For example, there was one point where they were talking about masturbation, and this is covered in my brief, and Dr. Maida said, well, of course she wouldn't have asked her in those words. If it were me, I would have said such and such, but we don't know what Ms. Suter said, and therefore we have no way of knowing what kind of filter went through these things. Another very significant issue is that Ms. Suter indicated that Diane told her at the time of the exam that she was not sexually active. However, at trial, Diane testified that she used sex toys with her girlfriend. Now, obviously, she could be cross-examined about that fact at trial, but Ms. Suter could not be cross-examined about the impact that information would have had on her findings because Ms. Suter wasn't there.
Could you address for me on the Maida testimony, the harmless error issue with respect to it? You're saddled with a plain error analysis here.
That's correct. And I believe that the state cannot meet its burden of showing that the error was harmless. We've got a situation here where we've got a confrontation issue. That's a constitutional right. And when an error is constitutional, the state bears the burden of showing that the error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. That's from Delaware versus Van Arsdale. And what the U.S. Supreme Court said there was that the correct inquiry, is whether, and this is a quote, assuming that the damaging potential of the cross-examination were fully realized, a reviewing court might nonetheless say that the error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, the Van Arsdale case also set forth certain factors to weigh when you get into this analysis, and I'd like to go over those for you, if I might. One is the importance of the witness's testimony in the prosecution's case. Well, here, the testimony of Dr. Maida as to what Ms. Suter found was used to support the fact that there, in fact, was sexual abuse in this case, so I submit that it was extremely important. The next factor is whether the testimony was cumulative. Well, this is the only medical evidence that there was, so it's not cumulative at all. Next, the presence or absence of evidence corroborating or contradicting the testimony of the witness on material points. Well, here we've got this whole issue with the sex toy and whether that would have made a difference in her testimony, and so I believe that factor also weighs in his favor. The extent of the cross-examination otherwise permitted is another factor, and they're talking about situations where a court shuts down part of the cross. Here there was obviously absolutely no cross-examination of Ms. Suter because she wasn't there. And the last factor is the overall strength of the prosecution's case. Now, the state talks about the fact that there were certain admissions made and that sort of thing, but I think it's very significant that the only other evidence aside from Ms. Suter's findings that there was sexual penile penetration was the complainant's testimony. The state conceded in their answering brief on page 14 and 17 that Mr. Maida never admitted to having sexual penile penetration of Diane, and so they conceded that. I think that goes very much to the harmless error analysis in this case. Also, I think when you consider, in addition to those factors, the fact that there was no testimony concerning Ms. Suter's qualifications, and yet her expert testimony was given by Dr. Maida, and Dr. Maida her qualifications were extensively gone into, and that sort of raises this up from a nurse practitioner to a pediatrician, but she was still just giving Ms. Suter's findings, and Ms. Suter's qualifications never were gotten into.
So your view is that Dr. Maida never offered any independent opinion of her own?
There were two instances where she offered her own opinion. One of those, was that she found the results of the exam to be consistent with Diane's
testimony as to what happened. That she said that was her opinion. But again,
made after she observed the exchange or the interview by Ms. Souter and Diane.
After she read Ms. Souter's report of that interview, but she never saw the interview or anything like that. And the thing is, she's going again by what Ms. Souter found, and then Dr. Maida says, I find that consistent with Diane's testimony. The other opinion that she gave, as I mentioned, was based on the videotape that Ms. Souter took, and Dr. Maida testified that there was, quote, an area of concern that she saw on the videotape and something not quite right there. But she did not get into the in-depth findings that Ms. Souter made and also indicated that she was at a disadvantage in making that determination because she was just viewing the videotape as opposed to having been present for the examination.
But she was able to be cross-examined as to the inherent limitations of her viewing that videotape. Fair?
Yes, I would believe so. The real concern is a lot of the other things that she testified to in terms of Ms. Souter found this and this and this is her diagram and that sort of thing, and there was no way to cross-examine that because all she was doing was relating what Ms. Souter said she found and what she drew on the diagram.
And in effect, putting an MD on that report.
Right, and putting the I can't even say it right now.
Well, I'd like to clarify something, and maybe I've got this wrong in the record at 351 and 353. It's my understanding that Maida's opinion is given after independent observations and review of Nurse Souter's video examination of Diane. Are you telling me that she didn't review the video?
No,
and that she didn't testify that she reviewed the video?
She did review the videotape, and that's when she testified.
Because you said a moment ago that the basis of her opinion was only after reviewing the report. I'm trying to determine what would be improper from Maida examining the video of an examination and then offering an independent opinion about that.
The problem
video.
Is that she indicated that she could not really see what Nurse Souter saw. She saw an area of concern, but she did not see the kind of...
That's an area of cross-examination. I'm trying to determine where is the violation, legal violation, from an expert who observes a video. It may have all kinds of defects. It may have all kinds of qualification problems associated with it. But where is the legal... violation or problem that exists in an expert that views the video and says, my opinion based on this video is X?
I think the problem is that that's not all the testimony she gave. There was a lot of...
Let's just confine it. There may very well be certain portions of her testimony that are improper and other portions that are proper. I'm trying to segregate those.
Okay.
As to this opinion, I want to make sure that we are on the same page. First, you do agree that she viewed the video.
That was her testimony, yes.
And that she offered an opinion based on her viewing video.
I believe that would be an accurate statement as well.
What is legally deficient about that opinion?
Even if that opinion is considered appropriate, I think it pales...
You don't want to answer my question. What is legally insufficient about that opinion?
I think that her testimony, the fact that she indicated that this was not as good as it could have been if it had been the real person who took the video, I think that diminishes the credibility and sort of puts it back as being Ms. Souter's video. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right. Ms. Lushitz.
May it please the court, I'm Lisa Luzich. I represent the state of Nevada, and I was trial counsel. I would submit to the court that the court shouldn't even reach this issue as it was not objected to in the lower court. At trial, the defense counsel knew from the very beginning, from calendar call, that Ms. Souter was not available, that she was out of the country, she was no longer employed by the county, and rather than continue the trial for somewhere in the vicinity of the 9th or 10th time, I had elected to call Dr. Mehta after asking her to review not only the report, but the diagram and the videotape of the colposcope, and that I was going to offer Dr. Mehta's testimony in lieu of Ms. Souter. Trial counsel for the defense knew that, made no objection to it, and strenuously cross-examined Dr. Mehta during the course of the trial. Cross-examined Dr. Mehta not only on the fact that when Dr. Mehta volunteered that I am at somewhat of a disadvantage because it helps to be there live in person and to see three-dimensional vaginal walls and whatnot, he cross-examined her about that, that, you know, we're getting a secondhand opinion here, and also cross-examined her about Phyllis Souter's findings and conclusions. So, although there was not actual cross-examination of the nurse who conducted the examination, there was cross-examination of the doctor, and that, I submit to the court, is sufficient.
But to the extent that Mehta is reciting Souter's findings, doesn't that clearly violate Melendez-Diaz?
I do not believe that. Well, first, in Melendez, the defense counsel objected in the trial court,
well,
and therefore
but it's
properly...
it's a constitutional problem, so it raises a plain error analysis.
Right. But in Melendez,
I appreciate
there was...
your concern. You're saying everybody knew this, we were aware of this going
into
the trial.
Moving on.
But now we're presented with a constitutional violation, a Crawford problem. So do you acknowledge or not that an expert cannot simply recite the findings of someone else and have that survive a Melendez-Diaz challenge?
I do not agree that it can't survive the challenge. In this particular case specifically, because not only was she reciting, but she reviewed the report herself and the video and the diagram. If Dr. Mehta had merely looked at the report and nothing else and said, Phyllis Souter said in this report X, Y, and Z, that may not have been sufficient. But that is not the issue before this court today. Before this court today is the issue of she was explaining what Phyllis Souter saw based on not only review of the report, but review of the video as well, and review of the diagram that Phyllis Souter drew describing the video. So there is a difference there.
So you're suggesting that under the Melendez-Diaz case, if the expert arrives at their own conclusion, they nevertheless get to repeat the opinion of someone else?
Only if it is consistent. If it's not, I would never offer an expert to look at a report and a video and not disagree with the and not agree with the report, but still say Phyllis Souter found this.
But isn't the harm in that identified in that case the inability of the defendant to cross-examine the expert whose findings are now being recounted?
There is harm in that, but in this particular case and in many others, they're still able to cross-examine the doctor who is, or the witness who is on the stand. There could, I expect, be situations where that would not be sufficient, depending on what the issue is.
Could you address counsel's plain error argument?
I disagree that there is plain error. I don't think that they have demonstrated that if it was even error, that it affected the defendant's substantial rights or that the defendant was prejudiced. This was a case of overwhelming evidence. This is a case where Diane testified based on years of abuse that there was not only the exam that was consistent with her description of what had occurred, but the defendant made statements So the jury heard not only from the defendant's own mouth, but they saw the video of the interview that the defendant did with the detective, wherein the defendant admitted to many of the acts that Diane described. Now, the fact that he didn't admit to all of the acts, I think, is fairly insignificant, because people rarely come in and tell a detective, yeah, I put my penis in that 13-year-old's vagina. They find that it is not quite as offensive when they say, well, yeah, I touched or I rubbed or whatnot. But it's the actual act of penetration that people don't often admit to. But above and beyond the videotape of himself describing the things that he had done, he had made admissions to the mother of Diane after the disclosure in front of her, the mother's son, Diane's brother, Max, in front of an independent other family witness. But not only that, he wrote an apology letter to Diane while he was with the detective, and while he was in custody, he sent letters to both the mother and to Diane saying, telling the mother, oh, don't bring her to court, tell her not to come in, tell her not to say that this happened so that I can get out of custody. And he writes a letter to Diane saying, well, if you come to court and say that it didn't happen, I'll buy you a car, I'll buy you a house, and I'll take care of you for the rest of your life. I'll get you an education, which is what you really need. I would submit that that is overwhelming evidence of consciousness of guilt. So when the court looks at it, even if you just excluded entirely Dr. Mehta's testimony of the exam that Phyllis Souter did, there was still overwhelming evidence of the defendant's guilt in this case. So when the court asks about plain error, I suggest that there not only wasn't plain error, there wasn't error at all in this case, insofar as the testimony of Dr. Mehta. But Dr. Mehta also, as the court just pointed out, testified as to her own opinion. Under 50.285, an expert can rely on almost anything in forming an opinion. And Dr. Mehta said that she reviewed the report, the diagram, and the video. And in her opinion, the description that Diane gave was consistent with what she saw, or what she saw was consistent with Diane's description. And contrary to counsel's description of what the report entailed, there are two different sections of questions in these Saint exams. One is where Phyllis Souter writes down the actual question she asks and writes down the actual answer that the child gives. And then there is another section that is a pre-printed form that says, were you kissed? Were you licked? Were you masturbated? Was it on the vagina? And was it whatnot? And she asks those questions, and then the victim gives a one-word yes, no, maybe answer. And those are just checked off. And Dr. Mehta just described those answers. So it's not as if there was interpretation by Phyllis Souter as to what Diane said. It was the actual comments, why are you here? I'm here because. When did it happen? It happened then. And those are all statements that are made for purposes of medical diagnosis or treatment. Therefore, they are not hearsay. They're excluded by the hearsay rule. Additionally, those statements, if there's any problem with them, Diane was there and testified and absolutely could have been cross-examined as to any of the statements that she made to Phyllis Souter, especially in light of the fact that trial counsel knew that Phyllis Souter was not going to be there to testify herself. He had the option of cross-examining Diane on any or all of those statements.
Counsel, although Ms. Burke didn't get a chance to address this, the first issue she raises in her brief about the instructions and the like and the sufficiency of proof of age 14, I'd like to direct your attention to that question of those issues.
As far as the instructions,
Can I just finish my question first?
Sorry.
That's all right. Legal question that's raised is interesting as to whether or not the age of the child is an element of the crime, or whether it's a element or a basis for sentencing, which is a completely separate issue. But could you address, regardless of that, why you feel count 9 had sufficient evidence to support the conviction?
I do agree that the age is an element of the crime. There are three different sexual assaults. There's sexual assault under 16, sexual assault under 14 in general. Sexual assault under 16, sexual assault under 14 were charged in this case. So absolutely the state needs to prove that the incidents occurred, whether she was either under 16 or under 14. As far as the instructions, the jury was instructed that that is an element of the crime, and there is an instruction that says that the jury must find beyond a reasonable doubt each and every element of each and every crime. Therefore, the jury was instructed that they had to find beyond a reasonable doubt that Diane was under 14 at the time that count 9 was committed, count 9 being the fellatio count. And I would submit that we did, in fact, prove that that occurred. Diane's testimony was not clear, but it was consistent when she always talked about it started when she was 12. He would take her thumb out of her mouth and put his penis in. It stopped when she stopped sucking her thumb when she was 14. But she was clear that it started when she was 12, and there were different discussions about when did it happen. It happened when I was in 7th grade or 8th grade, or when I was in middle school, or the summer between 7th and 8th grade. Well, Diane's testimony was very clear that in February of 2007, she dropped out of high school. She was in the 11th grade. In February of 2007, she was still 16. So she was 16 when she dropped out. Therefore, if you go backwards, and you don't have to figure out, like defense counsel states in their reply, when she entered school, you go backwards from 16, February 2007, when she dropped out. Therefore, the entire time she was in middle school, she was under 14. She did not turn 14 until she was in the 9th grade in September of 2004. So did it happen all the time when she was less than 14? No, but she's only charged with one count of fellatio, not 5, 12, or 17. So as long as they found that it happened once when she was 14, and it absolutely did because she said it started when she was 12 and it continued until she stopped sucking her thumb when she was 14. So I would submit to the court that that demonstrates beyond a reasonable doubt that it happened at least once, if not more than once, when she was less than 14.
Okay. Was there anything else you wanted to address?
There wasn't anything I wanted to address unless the court
has any questions from my colleagues? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
Okay. Ms. Firk, I'm going to give you a couple of minutes because I'd like you to address the question I asked counsel about that the first part of your brief and appellate issue.
I think the problem with that particular issue, I mean, obviously it's a question of fact as to whether the state showed what her age was, and I know the court can look at the record and make that determination as easily as anyone. I think the problem is with the instructions that were given, and if I might, the fact that the jury was, counsel for the state indicates that the jury was informed that they had to find beyond a reasonable doubt that she was under 14, but the instruction as it was actually framed says, a person who subjects a minor under 14 to sexual penetration against the minor's will or under conditions, so on and so forth, is guilty of sexual assault with a minor under 14/16. That makes it extremely confusing in terms of whether they really have to find that she was under 14. And I think the other problem is that instruction number 10 said, where a child has been a victim of sexual assault or lewdness with a minor and does not remember the exact date of the act, the state is not required to prove a specific date, but may prove a time frame within which the act took place. Well, in one of the counts, and I don't remember which one it is right now, the state even alleged a time period that went past her 14th birthday. So even on its face, one of the counts says, I think it went till December of the year that she turned 14 in September. I think those instructions were just incredibly confusing, and especially when the state in closing argument used instruction number 10 and basically said things blur, things get hazy, and I think that compounded the problem in terms of the jury making that determination she was under 14. Thank you.
All Just one additional question, though. The the count in which you say in the amended complaint they alleged a date past age 14, that count isn't one of the counts you're appealing on, I don't think. I think it's count 7.
Yes, that's count... courts.
Mm-hmm.
I should have never taken the brief apart.
I think it's 79.
That was... That was count 4, that he digitally penetrated between January 1st, 2002 and December 31st, 2004. She was born in 1990. So that's the, and that's one of the ones that I am appealing on.
Right. Okay. That's, and that's the one you were referring to in your argument.
Right, that's charged past
right.
her turning 14.
Okay, thank you. Any questions by my colleagues? All right, Ms. Burke, Ms. Lucich, we very much appreciate your arguments. Always a pleasure to have you here in court and presenting your views on these cases. Thank you.
Thank you.